Chapter 52. Delcasser was perfectly right. Lingard had come up on deck long before Mrs. Travers woke up with her face wet with tears. The burial party had returned hours before, and the crew of the brig were plunged in sleep, except for two watchmen, who at Lingard's appearance retreated noiselessly from the poop. Lingard, leaning on the rail, fell into a somber reverie of his past. Reproachful specters crowded the air, animated and vocal, not in the articulate language of mortals, but assailing him with faint sobs, deep sighs, and fateful gestures. When he came to himself and turned about, they vanished, all but one dark shape without sound or movement. Lingard looked at it with secret horror. "Who's that?" he asked in a troubled voice. "The shadow moved closer, colon, it's only me, sir," said Carter, who had left orders to be called directly the captain was seen on deck. "Oh, yes, I might have known," mumbled Lingard in some confusion. He requested Carter to have a boat manned, and when after a time the young man told him that it was ready, he said, "LL right," and remained leaning on his elbow. "I beg your pardon, sir," said Carter after a longish silence, "but are you going some distance?" "No, I only want to be put ashore on the sandbank." Carter was relieved to hear this, but also surprised. "There is nothing living there, sir," he said. "I wonder," muttered Lingard. "But I am certain," Carter insisted. "The last of the women and children belonging to those cutthroats were taken off by the sampans which brought you and the yacht party out." He walked at Lingard's elbow to the gangway and listened to his orders. "Directly there is enough light to see flags by, make a signal to the schooner to heave short on her cable and loose her sails. If there is any hanging back, give them a blank gun, Mr. Carter. I will have no shilly-shallying. If she doesn't go at the word, by heavens, I will drive her out. I am still master here for another day." The overwhelming sense of immensity, of disturbing emptiness, which affects those who walk on the sands in the midst of the sea, intimidated Mrs. Travers. The world resembled a limitless flat shadow which was motionless and elusive. Then against the southern stars she saw a human form that isolated and lone appeared to her immense. The shape of a giant outlined amongst the constellations. As it approached her, it shrank to common proportions, got clear of the stars, lost its awesomeness, and became menacing in its ominous and silent advance. Mrs. Travers hastened to speak. "You have asked for me. I am come. I trust you will have no reason to regret my obedience." He walked up quite close to her, bent down slightly to peer into her face. The first of the tropical dawn put its characteristic cold sheen into the sky above the shore of refuge. Mrs. Travers did not turn away her head. "Are you looking for a change in me?" "No. You won't see it. Now I know that I couldn't change, even if I wanted to. I am made of clay, that is too hard." "I am looking at you for the first time," said Lingard. I never could see you before. There were too many things. Too many thoughts, too many people. No, I never saw you before. But now the world is dead." He grasped her shoulders, approaching his face close to hers. She never flinched. "Yes, the world is dead," she said. "I'll look your fill then. It won't be for long." He let her go as suddenly as though he had struck him. The cold white light of the tropical dawn had crept past the zenith now, and the expanse of the shallow waters looked cold too, without stir or ripple within the enormous rim of the horizon where, to the west, a shadow lingered still. "Take my arm," he said. She did so at once, and turning their backs on the two ships they began to walk along the sands, but they had not made many steps when Mrs. Travers perceived an oblong mound with a board planted upright at one end. Mrs. Travers knew that part of the sands. It was here she used to walk with her husband and Delcasser every evening after dinner, while the yacht lay stranded and her boats were away in search of assistance which they had found. This was something that he had never seen there before. Lingard had suddenly stopped and looked at it moodily. She pressed his arm to rouse him and asked, "What is this?" "This is a grave," said Lingard in a low voice, and still gazing at the heap of sand. I had him taken out of the ship last night. Strange, he went on in a musing tone, how much a grave big enough for one man only can hold. His message was to forget everything. Never, never, murmured Mrs. Travers. I wish I had been on board the Emma. You had a madman there, she cried out, suddenly. They moved on again, Lingard looking at Mrs. Travers, who was leaning on his arm. I wonder which of us two was mad, he said. I wonder you can bear to look at me, she murmured. Then Lingard spoke again. I had to see you once more. That abominable Jorgensen, she whispered to herself. No, no, he gave me my chance, before he gave me up. Mrs. Travers disengaged her arm and Lingard stopped too, facing her in a long silence. I could not refuse to meet you, said Mrs. Travers at last. I could not refuse you anything. You have all the right on your side, and I don't care what you do or say. But I wonder at my own courage, when I think of the confession I have to make. She advanced, laid her hand on Lingard's shoulder and spoke earnestly. I shuddered at the thought of meeting you again. And now you must listen to my confession. Don't say a word, said Lingard in an untroubled voice, and never taking his eyes from her face. I know already. You can't, she cried. Her hand slipped off his shoulder. Then why don't you throw me into the sea, she asked, passionately. Am I to live on hating myself? You mustn't, he said with an accent of fear. Haven't you understood long ago that, if you had given me that ring it would have been just the same? Am I to believe this? No, no. You are too generous to a mere sham. You are the most magnanimous of men, but you are throwing it away on me. Do you think it is remorse that I feel? No. If it is anything, it is despair. But you must have known that, and yet you wanted to look at me again. I told you I never had a chance before, said Lingard in an unmoved voice. It was only after I heard they gave you the ring, that I felt the hold you have got on me. How could I tell before? What has hate or love to do with you and me? Hate? Love? What can touch you? For me you stand above death itself. For I see now that, as long as I live you will never die. They confronted each other at the southern edge of the sands, as if afloat on the open sea. The central ridge heaped up by the winds masked from them the very mastheads of the two ships, and the growing brightness of the light only augmented the sense of their invincible solitude in the awful serenity of the world. Mrs. Travers suddenly put her arm across her eyes and averted her face. Then he added, "That's all." Mrs. Travers let fall her arm, and began to retrace her steps, unsupported and alone. Lingard followed her on the edge of the sand uncovered by the ebbing tide. A belt of orange light appeared in the cold sky above the black forest of the shore of refuge and faded quickly to gold, that melted soon into a blinding and colorless glare. It was not till after as he had passed Jaffer's grave, that Mrs. Travers stole a backward glance and discovered that she was alone. Lingard had left her to herself. She saw him sitting near the mound of sand, his back bowed, his hands clasping his knees, as if he had obeyed the invincible call of his great visions haunting the grave of the faithful messenger. Shading her eyes with her hand, Mrs. Travers watched the immobility of that man of infinite illusions. He never moved, he never raised his head. It was all over. He was done with her. She waited a little longer, and then went slowly on her way. Shaw, now acting second mate of the yacht, came off with another hand in a little boat, to take Mrs. Travers on board. He stared at her like an offended owl. How the lady could suddenly appear at sunrise waving her handkerchief from the sandbank he could not understand. For, even if she had managed to row herself off secretly in the dark, she could not have sent the empty boat back to the yacht. It was to Shaw a sort of improper miracle. Delcasser hurried to the top of the side ladder, and as they met on deck Mrs. Travers astonished him, by saying in a strangely provoking tone, "You were right. I have come back." Then with a little laugh which impressed Elkasar painfully, she added with a nod downward, "And Martin too, was perfectly right. It was absolutely unimportant." She walked on straight to the taffrail and Elkasar followed her aft, alarmed at her white face, at her brusque movements, at the nervous way in which she was fumbling at her throat. He waited discreetly till she turned round, and thrust out toward him her open palm on which he saw a thick gold ring set with a large green stone. "Look at this, Mr. Elkasar. This is the thing which I asked you, whether I should give up or conceal the symbol of the last hour, the call of the supreme minute. And he said it would have made no difference. He is the most magnanimous of men, and the uttermost farthing has been paid. He has done with me. The most magnanimous. But there is a grave on the sands by which I left him sitting with no glance to spare for me. His last glance on earth. I am left with this thing. Absolutely unimportant. A dead talisman." With a nervous jerk she flung the ring overboard, then with a hurried entreaty to Elkasar, "Stay here a moment. Don't let anybody come near us," she burst into tears, and turned her back on him. Lingard returned on board his brig, and in the early afternoon the Lightning got underway, running past the schooner, to give her a let through the maze of shoals. Lingard was on deck, but never looked once at the following vessel. Directly both ships were in clear water he went below, saying to Carter Colin, "You know what to do." "Yes, sir," said Carter. Shortly after his captain had disappeared from the deck, Carter laid the main topsail to the mast. The Lightning lost her way, while the schooner with all her light kites a broad passed close under her stern, holding on her course. Mrs. Travers stood aft very rigid, gripping the rail with both hands. The brim of her white hat was blown upward on one side and her yachting skirt stirred in the breeze. By her side Elkasar waved his hand courteously. Carter raised his cap to them. During the afternoon he paced the poop with measured steps, with a pair of binoculars in his hand. At last he laid the glasses down, glanced at the compass card and walked to the cabin skylight which was open. "Just lost her, sir," he said. "All was still down there." He raised his voice a little. "You told me to let you know directly I lost sight of the yacht." The sound of a stifled groan reached the attentive Carter and a weary voice said, "All right, I am coming." When Lingard stepped out on the poop of the Lightning the open water had turned purple already in the evening light, while to the east the shallows made a steely glitter all along the somber line of the shore. Lingard, with folded arms, looked over the sea. Carter approached him and spoke quietly. "The tide has turned and the night is coming on. Hadn't we better get away from these shoals, sir?" Lingard did not stir. "Yes, the night is coming on. You may fill the main topsail, Mr. Carter," he said, and he relapsed into silence with his eyes fixed in the southern board, where the shadows were creeping stealthily toward the setting sun. Presently Carter stood at his elbow again. "The brig is beginning to forge ahead, sir," he said in a warning tone. Lingard came out of his absorption with a deep tremor of his powerful frame like the shudder of an uprooted tree. "How was the yacht heading when you lost sight of her?" he asked. "South as near as possible," answered Carter. "Will you give me a course to steer for the night, sir?" Lingard's lips trembled before he spoke, but his voice was calm. "Steer north," he said. End of the Project Gutenberg text of the rescue by Joseph Conrad. Terscoo by Gutenberg edition.